I'm going to start tonight by reading a koan from the Mumon Khan. And this is number 9. And the title of it is Daitsu Chiso, which is the name of a Buddha. And the case goes like this. A monk asked Seijo, who is a master, a monk asked Seijo of Koyo, Daitsu Chiso Buddha did Zazen for 10 kalpas in a meditation hall and could neither manifest the truth nor attain Buddhahood. Why was this? Seijo said, your question is a very appropriate one. The monk persisted. Why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing Zazen in the meditation hall? Seijo replied, because he didn't. That's the koan. So, just for the benefit of some new folks here, and it never hurts for any of us to hear these things again and again, a koan is a very traditional story in Zen Buddhism. And there are probably several thousand of them, although in the training of a Zen student, generally speaking, there's maybe somewhere between 300 and 500 or 600 that we will go through over a long period of time with our teacher. And each one of these is shining a light on a critical aspect of some essential truth that we learn simply through doing Zazen and doing this practice. So this koan appears early in the very first collection of 48 koan, which is the probably the most famous collection of koan, and that, by the way, is spelled K-O-A-N, called the Mumon Khan. And this happens early in this collection. So I brought this up because I think it's critically important, the message that it's showing. So essentially, just to translate it a little bit, because some of the terminology is difficult. Daitsu Chisho Buddha was one of the, what in Buddhism is called primordial Buddhas. Now, first we should start with the word Buddha. The literal meaning of Buddha is one who is awakened. The pictogram for Buddha in China, in Chinese, where Zen Buddhism started as Chan Buddhism, it came to Japan and they transliterated that word Chan, which originally came from the Sanskrit jhana, meaning absorption, which is what we're doing tonight. We're absorbing ourselves in the actual experience of the present moment. That's what jhana is. So when this branch of Buddhism, which was very much going to the root of how Buddhism started, how the Buddha became awakened, which was through this meditation posture, doing deep Zazen. He sat for 6 years and eventually came to awakening. So when he came to awakening, he was then the, quote, Buddha, the one who is awakened. We'll talk about what that is in a minute. So when this school of Buddhism came to China, it was called Chan Buddhism. In Japan, it was called Zen Buddhism. And we stuck with the word Zen because it's so simple. So this primordial Buddha, the primordial Buddhas were in the mythology of Buddhism, if you want to call it that, were the many, many Buddhas that came before the current Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived in 500 BC, who was an ordinary human being just like all of us here. And he is the Buddha of our particular era, meaning the perfectly enlightened person. Now, you don't have to believe any of this, and it doesn't matter, really. It's really what the teaching is pointing at, not so much the facts, whether they're true or not true. In this practice of Zen, there are no beliefs. This is about finding out in your own mind and body. So when we use these terms and these stories, they're really to point in a direction. They're not to create an idea in your mind that then becomes a special, tightly held belief as you see in so many fundamentalist approaches to religions. And there are fundamentalist approaches to Buddhism as well, but that's not Zen Buddhism. So this was one of the primordial Buddhas. Now, these primordial Buddhas passed on their wisdom, transmitted their wisdom from one to the next to the next, and then the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, actually in past lifetimes trained under these primordial Buddhas. So this particular primordial Buddha's name was Daitsu Chisho. Now, it says here he did Zazen, which is what we all just did here, for 10 kalpas in a meditation hall. Now, a kalpa is a very, very long period of time. The colorful description of it is how long it would take, the period of time it would take for an angel every 100 years to swoop down and just brush her wing on the top of the biggest mountain in the world, Mount Sumeru, which in Buddhist mythology is at the very center of the universe, the biggest mountain in the world. So if every 100 years this angel brushed their wing on the top of the mountain, the amount of time it would take for the mountain to be worn down to the ground, completely to dust, is one kalpa. It's just very, very colorful. This is from the Indian tradition where they will often contemplate these impossibly large numbers and impossibly large expenses of time. But get it that this was a really, really long time. So Daitsu Chisho Buddha did Zazen for 10 kalpas, that's 10 Mount Sumerus, in the meditation hall, and could neither manifest the truth nor attain Buddhahood. Why was this? So this is actually a story in Buddhism, that this particular primordial Buddha sat for a very, very long time and could not attain, quote, enlightenment. So the student asked, why was this? And the teacher answered in a somewhat flip way, but not really. It sounds flip, but there's a teaching embedded in his answer. His answer is, your question is a very appropriate one. He's pointing now at the question, this deep question, why? Why is it I've sat so long, I can't come to awakening, why? Why is that? And the teacher said, your question is a very appropriate one. You might say your question is a critical one. Your question is, when you hold that in the deepest part of yourself, is pointing at the answer. Now the student couldn't quite get the meaning of this and asked again, why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing Zazen in the meditation hall? And now the teacher, this is the first arrow, they often say traditionally in some of these Zen koan, the first arrow just grazed the student and the second arrow went deep. So the next answer, that the final answer that Seijo, this great master, replied was, because he didn't. Because he didn't. How's that possible? This is a primordial Buddha. The Buddhas are awakened. They're all awakened. How did this Buddha do Zazen for so long and not come to awakening? How's that possible? What does that mean? What does it mean that he didn't attain Buddhahood? He didn't. We're going to get into this in a little while, but I want to read you something now from the New York Times that I found a couple of days ago, and I copied it. And I found it very striking, and I'll just introduce it by saying that the author of this article is a Buddhist and has done long, intensive Buddhist meditation. I believe, from my reading of it, in the Theravada school, which is not the Zen method, but very, very similar. It would be the kind of meditation they do, the Insight Meditation Society, a mindfulness meditation, but that's exactly what Zazen is. It's mindfulness meditation. Just has a particular method to it. So this person wrote an opinion piece, and I read it, and I was very dismayed by it, and I'll read you some of it. So the title of it was More Mindfulness, Less Meditation. and it was by the author Tony Schwartz. And here's the first couple paragraphs. Here's the promise: meditation, and mindfulness meditation in particular, will reduce your cortisol level, blood pressure, social anxiety, and depression. It will increase your immune response, resilience, focus, and improve your relationships, including with yourself. It will also bolster your performance at work and provide inner peace. It may even cure psoriasis. Now, all of these things are claimed from mindfulness meditation, and I think he's saying these with little quotes around them and little tongue-in-cheek. So he goes on, the next paragraph. 50 Cent meditates. 50 Cent is one of the rappers. 50 Cent meditates, so does Lena Dunham and Alanis Morissette, and Steve Jobs meditated. And a bunch of other famous people meditate, and meditation is now in the news. It's very popular. It's growing again after many years of kind of being a quiet thing. I remember when I started sitting in 1970, it was enormous. It was a very big movement in this country, Zen Buddhism. And eventually, after many, many years, it didn't seem to be so popular, and there were some people who stuck with it. And now it seems to be making a resurgence, probably because people know that there's something more to life than the multitasking that we have to do and the map making that we need to do to survive. There's something there that isn't bringing happiness. And medication maybe will give you a cheap imitation of it, maybe it's necessary, but it doesn't get you all the way there. People are looking for something. And for some reason, this is breaking into the consciousness of people all around the world, this power of mindfulness meditation. So he talks about these various famous people now that are doing meditation. He said, mindfulness as a practice is sweeping through Silicon Valley. I think he lives in that area. A week from Saturday, 2,000 technology executives and other seekers will gather for a sold-out conference called Wisdom 2.0. Suddenly, a must-attend event for the cognoscenti. Even Rupert Murdoch, who is incidentally the owner of Fox News, has tried meditating, summing up its appeal in a haiku-like tweet. Quote, "Everyone recommends. Not that easy to get started, but said to improve everything," end of quote. Then his next statement is, really? For what it's worth, I don't think so. Then he talks about how he began meditating 25 years ago. He sat for 17 years. He tried very hard, but for some reason it didn't fix his relationships. It didn't make him happier. It didn't do a lot of things that he was aiming for, that he thought it would do for him. Now, I think some of what he's saying, he must know better than this. I think some of what he's saying is to create a very controversial piece in the New York Times, something that will be read and emailed around a lot, something that's going to shake people up. But he goes on eventually to say, I think what's really needed is more mindfulness to our everyday activity and less of this meditating on a specific object with the intent of getting something. I think actually there is a deep truth in what he's saying, although the way he says it would ordinarily scare people off, because he's saying it in a very unsubtle way. And it is promoted this way. If mindfulness meditation is promoted as a way to be happier, more centered, to achieve more in life, to make your relationships wonderful, to end up with some glowing rainbow around your head, then inevitably you are going to be disappointed, because you will constantly hold in your mind a picture of life, a picture of what you're going to achieve, a picture of yourself that is not what you are right now, that you are moving towards. And your meditation will then be a striving to become something that you are not right now. which only deepens the division inside, that I'm not good enough, I need to change myself, I need to be better, and I'm going to take this ancient wisdom that is supposed to make you float on a cloud in enlightenment and endlessly, perfectly happy, and I'm going to use it and get there myself. And you split yourself in two. What are the two sides? One side is the watcher who's judging you, who's seeing if you're making progress, to see if you're getting towards the other part, which is this made-up image in your mind of how you ought to be, how you want to be, how you will eventually be. And people get bitterly disappointed when they do mindfulness meditation with this attitude of mind, and they don't get anywhere. They end up feeling frustrated. Now, the first question I would ask is, Tony, how could you move in this direction and find it so useless for 17 years? Tony, what are you doing? You're either doing something wrong or you're beating yourself bloody against a brick wall for a long, long time. So this is why I'm saying some of what he's saying I think is a bit overblown, overplayed. He goes on to quote a couple of other meditators who found that meditation didn't get them there. But I think he misunderstood what they were really pointing at, and he pulled out quotes out of context. One of the people he quoted was Jack Kornfeld, who you may know. Jack Kornfeld is a very, very well-known, I'd have to say famous teacher in Vipassana, in mindfulness meditation of the Theravada school. And he has written many, many books. He's taught thousands of people. He's greatly respected. And he himself did very hard training, certainly early in his experience in Buddhism. He went to Thailand and Burma and practiced intensively. And so this author here is quoting Jack Kornfeld. And here's the quote. While I benefited enormously from the training in the Thai and Burmese monasteries where I practiced, he wrote, I noticed two striking things. First, there were major areas of difficulty in my life, such as loneliness, intimate relationships, work, childhood wounds, and patterns of fear that even deep meditation didn't touch. Second, among the several dozen Western monks and a lot of Asian meditators I met during my time in Asia, with few notable exceptions, most were not helped by meditation in big areas of their lives. Meditation and spiritual practice can easily be used to suppress and avoid feeling or to escape from difficult areas of our lives, end of quote. Now, I think what Jack Kornfeld is saying is true to a very great extent. And I think that this author, unfortunately, pulled it entirely out of a much bigger context, which I believe this koan I read early on is pointing at. And that's the misuse of this meditation. The use of this meditation to change yourself into something better, to get rid of something that's blocking you, to use it as a tool to get something else to happen that isn't happening right now, to become something that you're not. But when you use this meditation, this Zazen meditation in that way, you are missing something very, very critical. You're missing the essential faith in this path. And while I said before, this path harbors no beliefs, and one of the most pernicious beliefs would be that doing meditation like this is going to fix your life. It's going to make you perfectly happy. It's going to fix all your relationships. It's going to get rid of all your wounds of childhood, all your despair, all your fear. That's one of the myths, one of the mistakes. That's a belief. What is your actual experience? Now, what is the faith underlying this? Why do people who have proper teaching in this method and do it from the proper standpoint believe deep inside? First, the faith appears this way. There's something that I'm missing. There's some place I'm not seeing clearly. I know that it's there. I don't know how to get there. Let me look for a way. They somehow, by karma, by cause and effect, stumble upon a path that says, what you need to do if you want to answer this question is to go into the center of your experience, to embrace your actual moment-by-moment experience with great attentiveness and find out what you find there. Now, the faith goes deeper. The faith essentially is this. From the very beginning, I was always whole and complete. From the very beginning, I never lacked anything. All that were ideas in my mind, comparisons I learned to make, templates of reality that I created, both because I was taught that way in order to survive in the world where map making is essential, and because I live in a culture that promotes certain attitudes towards myself, that I'm not good enough. I need to have whiter teeth. I need to be prettier. I need not to have wrinkles. I can't show any aging. I have to be perfectly intelligent and have this and that many degrees. I have to have lots of money. All these things, all these ideas that we build up. And what do? We bring those ideas, we bring that sense of lacking something, that sense of wanting to be better, so to want to perfect ourselves, we bring it to this practice, just as we bring it to every other aspect of our life. Doing something for the sake of an end product, not for the sake of itself. Doing something to get something else, so that we're constantly chasing after something that we can never quite reach. And that's the human condition. So we come here, and obviously we have that momentum coming here. Now, luckily, embedded in the teachings of Zen Buddhism, and if you happen to find a teacher who teaches you properly, guides you, points in a direction properly, you will get it very quickly that that is the wrong direction. So remember now this koan. Daitsu Chisho Buddha sat in the meditation hall for 10 kalpas, and still he couldn't manifest Buddhahood. He couldn't come to awakening. Why? Your question is a very appropriate one. Remember this saying by this wonderful 27-year-old Japanese woman back in the early 1900s who came to a series of profound awakenings over a period of several days and wrote letters to her Zen master, Harada Roshi, who happens to be in our lineage here. He's our great, great spiritual grandfather. She wrote to him after one deep enlightenment, "What a relief to discover that just as I am perfect. What a relief to discover that just as I am perfect." Now this practice is showing us what that perfection means. What does that mean? You have to find that out in the deepest place in yourself to be convinced of it. Now, your teacher or others can tell you that, you can read it in books, but until you find it in your deepest self, you can't really utilize it. It feels blocked by so many other things. So when these folks encountered Buddhism, they had the momentum of this comparison mind, the sense of lacking, the sense I need to make myself into a better person, I need to change myself. And now I've found the way. This is the most powerful way. This is the most thorough way. This is the only way. I'm going to do it through mindfulness Buddhist meditation. And obviously, they got caught there. They got stuck there. It's very, very important not to get stuck there. Now, it's no mistake that this koan appears so early in this essential collection of koan for every Zen student as you move deeper into your practice. That this Buddha, this Daitsu Chisho Buddha, was already Buddha. already Buddha. How can this Buddha attain Buddhahood? How can you attain it if you already are it? This is the essential point. If you use this practice to attain something, you're going in the wrong direction, and 10 kalpas later, you still haven't gotten there. You could do it forever. But if you understand that you already are it, if you utilize this practice to awaken to what you actually are, your what we call true nature, then you will realize that just as you are perfect. So this kind of practice is not the kind of practice that holds up a template to which you compare yourself, your failing, lacking self, that needs to be improved to this state of perfection, which in our mind we call enlightenment, Buddhahood, whatever. What this practice does is it enables you through attentiveness, through open-heartedness, through clarity of mind, through holding your mind on one thing as the thoughts of comparison pass through and no longer catch you. You see them operate, but you see that they're just like everything else. They're like sounds in the room. They're like the smell of incense. I don't have to give them meaning. I don't have to give these thoughts reality. I can see that they're operating. They have a reason for being there. If they could have been any other way, that's the way they would have been right now. But because of all the things I've learned and all the momentum of my past comparison-mindedness, they arise in my zazen. But in my zazen, I stay in the present moment and I observe them passing through. So this zazen is very inclusive, is very embracing. This is the zazen that begins to get it, that exactly as you are right now, you are perfect, meaning could not have been any different. You are the perfect result of all the causes and conditions coming to this moment. Therefore, you are not comparable to anything else. What you are right now is incomparable, therefore absolute. Therefore, you must embrace it. Now, embracing it means you allow it in your awareness. That's what dhyana is. Dhyana is allowing. Dhyana is not fighting. Dhyana is not getting rid of. Dhyana is not transforming something into something else. Dhyana is vast spaciousness, allowing exactly the way this world is right now to appear in your awareness with clarity, to allow it to appear. Now, does that fix your life? No. Does that make you wealthy? No. If you want to get wealthy, you have to get out of the zendo, go get a job, make money, etc., etc. If you want to fix your relationships, you have to bring what you've learned on your sitting cushion, this embracing, accepting. If just as I am, I'm perfect, then my lover, just as they are perfect, my friend, just as they are perfect, meaning the perfect manifestation of karma right now. It doesn't mean that change isn't needed. It doesn't mean that effort isn't required. It only means that right now, if it could have been one iota different, that's how it would be. So I can wrap my arms around it, meaning I can allow it in my awareness. So now the fighting, the struggling, the comparison-mindedness starts to loosen up, starts to drop away, and things change of their own accord. So if change happens, if you feel happier, if you feel more accepting of yourself and others, it's a byproduct of this practice. It's not the aim. The minute you make it an aim, you'll never get there. It'll take you 10 kalpas to get there. So that's an essential point of this practice. So, the way we do this practice is we pick up a focal point and we hold it in our awareness so that we can see it very, very clearly exactly as it is. Exactly as it is. It's this actual breath, exactly as it is. The breath is very neutral. We don't have to change it. We don't have to be afraid of it. We don't have to fight it. We don't have to improve it. Just as it is perfect. So we start with something like that. And then we notice that other things come in. Memories, feelings, emotions, thoughts. They're just like this breath. We hold them in our awareness like that. We don't fight them. We create a big space around them. So that is an essential point of Zazen. So this koan, just coming back to it, this final statement, why did he not attain Buddhahood? And Seijo finally said, because he didn't. Because he didn't. Why aren't I happy? I've done Zazen. Why do I still have this childhood? Because you still have it. Because that's the way it is right now. What is this pointing at? Because he didn't. Because just the way he is perfect. He doesn't have to be different. He can embrace this in his awareness. And doing that is the definition in Zen of perfection. It's being the space within which the absolute world appears. So this is the attitude of mind to bring to this practice. We may have a little time for a couple of questions, so I'll just open it up if anyone, including the new folks, have any questions about it. And if not, we'll say the four vows. Okay, so I'll end there.